This is Sundays with Jessica Norwood, and this is episode number one. And you can get all of the headliner notes, show notes. They are available in my Medium post that I associate along with the podcast. This episode, episode one, is called An American Sky, and it follows a Black History Month trip that I took to Equal Justice Initiative's Legacy and Memorial Museum, where they talk about America's history of lynching. And this story, American Sky, follows what it looks like to look above and to see a hanging body in our sky. A couple other things that I want to really make sure that I notice. So we will be talking a little bit about issues of lynching and so forth. So I want to make sure that we give you a disclaimer and let you know that this is for a mature audience, and to really do the best that you can around preparing for your self-care.
I'm Jessica Norwood, and I'm a free Black girl with receipts. I'm a trailblazer in Black and social economic justice, and I'm an authentic curator of the culture. I am the queen mother baby, and I manage the affairs of our hearts and our money. And this podcast is about Black wealth and the legacy of the racial wealth gap. You know, they say that wealth is where the past meets the present, which basically means that for Black wealth, it's where the legacy of racism lives on. For every dollar a white person has, a Black person has just 1 cent. Inside of that number is the untold story of Black economics in America. It's the story of how Black wealth tries to grow despite unimaginable deaths and lynch mobs. How Black wealth keeps trying to find the light at the end of the tunnel despite largely being cut out from policies like the New Deal and GI Bill. And Black wealth that tries to grow crookedly through areas of housing, education, and mass incarceration discrimination. These are the stories of what happens to Black wealth. You know, the racial wealth gap is pretty straightforward. White people have way more money than everyone else. And it's a fact that remains largely unaddressed. And it's a fact that has everything to do with racism. I approach this podcast the way that Maya Angelou taught me. She said, "I have a great respect for the past. And if you don't know where you've come from, you don't know where you're going."
And thank you to our sponsors, RSF Social Finance and The Runway Project, where we are making patient loans to African-American businesses in the friends and family round, those kinds of rounds that matter and are impacted because of this racial wealth gap. And I have to tell you, there is a disclaimer today that this is really for mature audiences. We are talking about some subject matter that can be really triggering. This episode does talk about lynching in great detail. And so if this is not the right time for you, don't worry. I will still be here. You can come back. And if this is the right time for you, make sure that you're generous with yourself, that you give yourself space to really take care of your emotions. Thank you. I stood at the same place enslaved people were sold. I stood where my mama's mama's mama stood, and I looked up at that sky. Near me was this map showing a warehouse where they sold people who looked like me. And beside the map was a graphic showing the exact proximity of the business offices near the auction block. There were names of men, names I'm sure I recognize today as the city's lawyers, politicians, and leaders listed as slave investor. Slave investor, my investments are into freedom. I reached up and touched the swinging heavy metal. They were easily like coffins in the sky. I took a deep breath and I prayed, "My God, this is an American sky, where stars are both guides, but they sparkle like the loved ones who've gone too soon, reminding us to always look up toward God. This is the American sky where surely Grandpa Crawford's body swung heavy and thick like smoke, like coughing spells that come up raw and sting the back of the throat. This is American sky. It has rich oil, rich earth, blood-soaked roots that reach through time to find us. This American sky. Singing, God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who has brought us thus far on the way underneath this here American sky." This is the Anthony Crawford story, an African-American man killed by a lynch mob in Abbeville, South Carolina in 1916. Now, this story is told with edits due to time, but the story in its entirety can be found in the headliner notes along with this podcast. These are the words of Doria Johnson, the great-great-granddaughter of Anthony and Tebby Crawford, and the great-great-granddaughter of George and Annabelle Crawford, and the granddaughter of Joseph and Fanny Crawford Brooks, and the daughter of Dr. Charles and Helen Brooks Johnson. Doria tells about her great-great-grandfather's lynching in 1916 in Abbeville, South Carolina, by a crowd that's estimated to be between 200 and 400 white people. Now, this ordeal lasted all day. His body was beaten and dragged through town to show other Negroes what would happen to them if they had gotten insolent. Finally, he was taken to the county fairgrounds, strung up to a tree and riddled with bullets. Although we've heard his body was thrown on someone's lawn, we've yet to locate his grave, she said. The family was ordered to vacate their land, wind up their business, and get out of town, and they did just that. His crime, you might ask? Cursing a white man for offering him too low of a price for cottonseed. He was trying to sell and being too rich for a Negro. Anthony Crawford was born in January 1865, and he was owned by Ben and Rebecca Crawford in Abbeville, South Carolina. He would walk 14-mile round trip to and from school each day, and he was known to be quite a scholar. Now, when Anthony finished school, he was a laborer for Ben Crawford until Thomas Crawford, Anthony's father, died in 1893 and deeded him some land. And he was the only one of his nine siblings that could sign his name, so the land then goes to Anthony. Anthony, who's affectionately known as Andy, has 13 children, all of whom lived on the land with their spouses and their children. And he built a school on the land. He built a school for children, all the children, the black children in Abbeville. He also held office with the Masons of South Carolina, and he was a secretary for 19 years and chief financial prop of the Chapel of AME Church. In October of 1894, he was the assistant marshal of a grand parade in which 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 people would assemble by trades he was well-known, well-loved. At that time, in 1904, the Abbeville Medium reports, Anthony P. Crawford, colored, sold a load of splendid corn of his own raising in the city last week. His fat mules, good wagon, and prosperous appearances led us to inquire particularly about his crop. He owns the farm and farms the old Belcher place. He holds in his own right 500 acres of land in 3 tracts, paid for by his own labor. This year, his corn crop was 1,000 bushels, of which he sold 250. He made 200 gallons of syrup and 48 bales of cotton, and on November 26th, he sold $662 worth of cotton and has made other sales. He has 6 horses, 12 head of cattle, 18 hogs, 2 good wagons, a McCormick rake, a new top buggy. He also has a good bank account and a family of 13 children. Andy Crawford was the wealthiest Negro farmer in and around Abbeville. I mean, his holdings were at least 10% of all land owned by Negroes in the county. He would loan whites money between harvests. And he was one of the first folks that changed from cotton to corn before the other white farmers did, because he really did understand what was happening with boll weevil. And he's estimated at the time somewhere around 20,000, 50,000. Nobody's quite sure, but we do estimate that that is in the millions today. And he's really cited as being a law-abiding citizen, really proud. And so it is interesting to note what happens when we come to the morning of October 21st, 1916. Andy rode his buggy and horse into town to W.D. Barksdale's store. And cotton was selling at this time for 90 cents a bushel, but Barksdale ordered Andy to pay him 85 cents. And so Andy, being the business person he is, he tells Mr. Barksdale that he really has already gotten a better offer than that, and that he could just gather his seed and he's just gonna leave. But Barksdale calls him a liar. Now Andy curses him and tells him he's trying to cheat him, and he will take his seat somewhere else. And the two men begin to argue out on the square town, on the town square, so much so that a store clerk nearby hears the commotion, and he already comes out with an axe. Andy backs off towards the square, and he's arrested by Sheriff Burtz for cursing at Mr. Barksdale. Now, by the time Sheriff Burtz and Andy reach the jail, word has gotten out that a Negro had cursed a white man, and crowds start to gather at the square. Once the crowd spreads back out, Andy pays his bail and the sheriff lets him out the side door, really to avoid more commotion. He's headed for a gin in the short distance away when he spots this mob crowd. And he can hear them coming. He can see them. So he hides in the boiler room of the gym. And a gentleman by the name of McKinley Cann, he leads the crowd towards him. And Andy picked up a 4-pound hammer and crushed the skull of Cann. And he would have killed him had somebody not grabbed his arms. Sheriff Burtz begged the crowd, "Don't kill Andy." And they agreed to keep him in jail until they could be assured that Cann would survive the injuries. Now, while in jail, Andy ordered a doctor and told a friend to get his coat from the gin and give his bank book to his family. He said, "I thought I was a good citizen." The crowd soon took over the jail and beat Andy until he was unconscious, then dragged him out into the square where he regained consciousness, got to his feet, and fought 50 feet up the road before being hit with a rock in the back of the head. 20 white men kicked him, beat him, tied him to the back of a buggy, dragged him through the black neighborhoods, then finally strung him to a tree and unloaded 200 rounds into what was left of his body. At the time of his death, Anthony Crawford owned 427 acres of the prettiest cotton land in the county. I stood at the same place enslaved people were sold. I stood where my mama's mama's mama stood, and I looked up at that sky. Near me was this map showing a warehouse where they sold people who looked like me, and beside the map was a graphic showing the exact proximity of the business offices near the auction block. There were names of men, names I'm sure I recognize today as the city's lawyers, politicians, and leaders listed as slave investor. Slave investor, my investments are into freedom. I reached up and touched the swinging heavy metal. They were easily like coffins in the sky. I took a deep breath and I prayed, "My God, this is an American sky, where stars are both guides, but they sparkle like the loved ones who've gone too soon, reminding us to always look up toward God. This is the American sky where surely Grandpa Crawford's body swung heavy and thick like smoke, like coughing spells that come up raw and sting the back of the throat. This is American sky. It has rich oil, rich earth, blood-soaked roots that reach through time to find us. This American sky. Singing God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who has brought us thus far on the way, underneath this here American sky."
You've just been listening to a piece, an original piece from me, that was inspired by going on a Black History Month trip in 2019 to the Equal Justice Initiative's Legacy Museum and Memorial. And the piece talks about seeing these metal pieces. If you ever go to the museum, you'll see them. They kind of hang like coffins in the sky. And one of those legacy memorials talked about Anthony Crawford. And I was really compelled and interested in the story because it really talked about what happens when you have this violence, this racial terror, just because a black man, this black man is really wealthy. And so I want to add a little bit more texture and color to what happens after this. And really what his great-granddaughter is saying about this, whose words I read in the passage before. So at this point, you have to understand that Anthony Crawford is not just anybody. I mean, he is the wealthiest black man in this town. And this is the kind of, you know, when we talk about generational wealth building, that we really talk about how we've lost that. So Roy Nash at that time is the secretary of the NAACP, and he is sent down to Abbeville for an investigation. And the notes talk about how Nash has to act as if he's there to buy land so he can really get close to everybody who's involved, because they know that, you know, folks are not being forthright about what has actually happened to Mr. Crawford. So he discovers that those responsible not only ran the Crawford family out, but they closed all of the Black businesses except for one. All of them. Nash, while he's undercover for the NAACP, also learns that the orders are given by the people who lynched Anthony Crawford that they would kill the entire family if they didn't leave town. So the night of that lynching, the Crawford family, the children, and their children waited in the trees with guns, thinking that these lynchers are going to come. And while they never came, the Crawfords knew that was only a short amount of time, and they left Abbeville. And one of the last surviving children of Anthony Crawford died a few years back, and he has said, "I never want to see Abbeville again. As long as I live, I wouldn't give Abbeville County a nickel." You know, this is a really important story, I think, because it really starts to underscore, I think, the impact that it had on not only this family, but all the Black people in that town. And remember, Mr. Crawford is also the person who is involved in the church. He is got schools on his property. It is, in fact, really a community that is destroyed. And this Black man who's worked so hard at trying to become wealthy is lynched. I think the part of this story, there were two parts of it that really completely broke my heart. And I think it really comes down to the quotes that he's known to have said when he is inside of that boiler room and he ends up hitting this man who is coming to kill him. And everybody is panicked and they're freaked out and they're like, "Did he just kill a white man?" And the sheriff at the time gets everybody to calm down and say, "Okay, let's just wait and see if this guy survives it." But Anthony Crawford knew that this wasn't going to hold. And so he calls for a family friend, a doctor, and tells them to go and get his coat pocket. And he gives the family the bank book. And he says, "I thought I was a good citizen." I think that's the part that crushed me about the story, was the phrase, "I thought I was a good citizen." You know, at the time when Anthony Crawford is killed, the family does lose the land. The killers were never brought to trial. And although they were brought before a grand jury, they decided that there was not enough evidence to indict. They lost the land, and through two mortgages, back taxes, a stock market crash of 1929, and the family really being forced out of that area, those who could stay really couldn't keep up with the payments. And I think it just leaves this really horrific legacy about what it means to be a proud person, believe in education, and try to take care of your family. And you can't. You can't. One of the things that I think really just stood out for me that isn't included in the main piece that I read to you, but I do want to read it for you now. If this is actually from an ad that Anthony Crawford had taken out, and his granddaughter, great-granddaughter, Doria Johnson, included this in her piece. And I just want to read it to you to close. He says, "It will be the highest endeavor of our lives to strive to make as good citizens in the future as we have in the past. And to those who oppose or differ with us, I have nothing but a good and friendly feeling. For individuals as well as nations sometimes differ, but it's right to settle their differences legally and amicably." You You have been listening to Sundays with Jessica Norwood, and I hope you enjoyed my little Sunday sermon. I appreciate you being here. You know, for me, when I was growing up, Sundays really did mean church. And it was there that I learned this ritual of listening and remembering. One Sunday morning, I asked my mama why we had to still listen to all of these stories from people from so long ago. I remember she looked down at me and she said, "Jessica, we do it to remind ourselves that there is no time like the present time to do the right thing." Do the right thing. That phrase still echoes in my mind because it taught me that we were not there on Sunday just to listen and just to remember. It was also about action. Do the right thing. The action that one takes of doing the right thing is what it means to be right, to live right, to do the right thing. And I remember her words. And after she said it, the pastor stood right before the church at the close of service. Congregation was there, arms outstretched, and these big heavy doors of the sanctuary swung open. And he said in this rich and rounded tone, "The doors of the church are open. Go out," the pastor would say, "with an open heart and an open mind." So I say to you, go out with an open heart and an open mind. Until we meet again, peace. Sundays with Jessica Norwood is an investigative arts podcast that tells the real stories of people, policies, and the scandals that shape the racial wealth gap, a gap that is so large that for every dollar that a white person has, a black person has just 1 cent. If you'd like to support this content and the content that I have on Facebook and other places, please go to my Patreon page and consider a monthly contribution. Any amount is, I'm sure, enough. You'll be billed that amount, whether it be $1 or $5, $15, whatever, at the beginning of the month, and you can cancel at any time. And when you send me something, I send you a little gift of thanks. Thank you.